Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't a fucking. Ain't a fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Well, we get straight now?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Next!
A little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
John, how you doing over there, man?
Feeling like 37 cents.
I tell you, I've come through the other side of that funk that I've been in for a
That's
few
good.
Weeks.
Man, yeah. I had a gig last night and just felt miserable before. I just had a great gig, and then the ride home felt like crap, but it was incredible how it just lifted me out of that insanity. I was happy. I was kind of stressing at first, but
the old music is the best medicine theory there came to pass, huh?
Yeah, I might agree with that on certain days.
Well, we got a busy show today. It's one of these shows that the listeners love. It's a gear show, man. It's good stuff. We got some fun stuff talking about. So we're not going to spend too much time going into the wormhole of ancillary stuff. We're pretty much going to jump into
Wait,
the... Huh?
What? I love that. I'm a button pusher, man. I like talking about sports because it annoys some listeners of ours. I'm just going to come clean. I can't believe you're shutting me down.
Man, I'll tell you, it's the most wonderful time of the year. It's not Christmas. It's right now. We got baseball, NHL playoffs, baby.
NHL, baby. It gets dirty.
Let me tell you, first round of the NHL playoffs, better than the NBA finals. Easily.
I haven't had a chance to watch a game, but you and quite a few other friends have been just going gaga over the first few games.
Amazing.
So, going to jump in. Anyway, sorry. Oh, I'll shut up now with that annuary or whatever crap it is. Let's just move on.
See, you're already feeling better.
Talk about some drums.
Feeling better, man. The show, the power of music has lifted his spirits.
I got to go to the bathroom.
I'll just keep talking over that, you know.
Your positivity is making me sick.
I'm feeling better, man.
All right, let's go.
I'm out of my Jerry Lewis lozenge stage.
We're slowly morphing into this requested Phil and his togetherness and John and his cranky ass mindset. But hey, I'm going to go with the boss here, and we're moving forward.
I also would like to say I'm several days into consistent meditation also. So. You know.
See, I just start, if I meditate, I start thinking about like debt and stuff. So I get distracted.
Remember, begin again, John. Begin again.
I always begin thinking again about debt. For you youngsters out there, avoid credit cards and stuff like that. Don't do it. You don't need all that gear that everybody tells you you need.
Wait a minute, man. Hang on. You're double talking. You're talking out of the side of your neck, because look, we're going to give a double whammy here on this.
Okay.
Because we're going to talk about free stuff that does involve gear, cuz you do need gear, especially if it's free. Do you smell what I'm stepping here?
I smell it.
Yeah. So, look, folks, by the time you hear this, you're going to have most likely a scant 24 hours to get your review on our iTunes page so that you can be registered in the first ever Drummer's Weekly Groovecast giveaway. Yes, that's correct. The first ever Drummer's Groovecast giveaway. So all you have to do to get registered is just point your little browser straight to the iTunes store. Go to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast podcast page and leave us a written review. Yes, a written review. It has to be written. You can't just click the stars. You need to click those 5 stars and then give us a short written review. That way we will have your iTunes handle, and then we will be making a drawing on Tuesday, April 18th. And then we'll give you roughly the time. It's probably going to be late morning, early afternoon. When we get a little bit closer to the time, maybe on Monday or so, we'll start sending out some tweets and some Facebook posts and letting you know the exact time that we're going to do the drawing. And so now you're asking yourself, well, my gosh, I'm going to go there and I'm going to spend all of a minute and a half. What are you fools going to give me? Well, here's what we're going to give you. And right now, let me say this. You got about a 1 in 15 chance of winning.
Woo!
I mean, you're not going to get better odds than that, are you, John?
I don't think so.
So
it's
yeah.
odd that those are the odds, but whatever.
Shall we say peculiar?
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Ain't that
peculiar?
Da-da-da.
Yeah. Yep. So here's what you're going to register to win. The first place winner will have their choice of a Paiste 20 Series 10-inch splash cymbal. And John, what is the manufacturer's suggested retail price of said cymbal? It's from Switzerland, so it's expensive.
Yeah, I want to say they're like $140.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you'd pay for it.
Maybe. Right.
$150 maybe. They're not cheap.
Absolutely, they're not
I've
cheap.
I've estimated our gifts have a street value of about $100.
All right. And then our second choice.
That's better than $10.
And it's also better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick.
I'm not really fond of splash cymbals, so I might disagree.
Get a lot of stand sound.
Yeah.
Stand noise, you know?
True.
Yeah. So, but anyway, here we are talking down our gift.
God, I'm an idiot.
It's
awesome, man. It actually makes a great left side ride.
We're going to talk that's about
like,
that.
That's like something that everybody yeah. raves about, so I just thought I'd make something up.
So, our second gift is a Gretsch Drums t-shirt. So you got a choice there. And then the second name.
I love t-shirts.
I do too. The second.
They're made up for it.
The second prize winner will automatically default to the prize that the first person who gets name gets drawn doesn't want. It goes to that. And we will be in touch with you fine folk. You know, as soon as we finish the drawing, which will be on Facebook Live. You're going to get to see us live and in person. I mean, I know that you've seen us before in still photos, but there's something about the magic of video, John, that will draw the listeners in.
Ugh.
You're going to be well by then, man. You're going to be feeling good. I can tell.
I'll be okay.
It's going to be great, man.
Hey. I was thinking about what if like 7 people claim they're Alonzo Drummer Master 402 at AOL.com. Don't be trying to sneak one over on us, guys.
We're gonna flesh out all the hucksters.
That internet, man, there's some sneaky devils in there.
It's the internet is one of the roots of all evil, and it's generally used for bad. I'm going to go ahead and say that.
Yeah.
We're a beacon of shining light.
Woo.
Into a dark room of...
Have you seen my webpage with all my pictures of my close personal friends that happen to be famous?
Is it in that thing called, like, the Book of Many Faces? Is that what that is, or...?
No, I don't have one of those. But that's kind of... That's an evil little plot on the internet I see too often. They're not your close friends.
Would we say that there are people that you may have like shared the stage with? Is that
yeah? That's the running the running joke is Eric Clapton played on Tuesday night and I played the same club like or the venue like Thursday night, so I've shared the stage with him.
Although there is a shred of truth to that.
Oh, that's exactly why it is regularly conveyed.
Yeah, I mean, you and I both have like played like Gwinnett Center and like Phillips, and so I mean, we've shared the stage with you two.
Yeah, Rolling Stones. I mean, I've shared the stage with everybody.
Yeah,
I shared the stage with Count Basie. Louis Armstrong. I've shared it with just about everybody, man.
We should make this shell game happen of like selling some of our gear that has also like shared the stage with, you know how people like that kind of this drum set, you know, played behind the Rolling Stones shared. Or something like that. Shared the stage.
This drum set was used on the same stage as John Philip Sousa.
That's good stuff, man.
If you're going to be jive about it, just take it to the next
level.
Just
go the whole way, huh? You know? Well, all right. So anyway, folks, don't forget.
I got off on a tangent.
Yes, you did.
So there.
So make sure you swing by the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast page on iTunes. Submit that short written review. And then sit back with your fingers crossed on Tuesday and win some free gear. Look at it this way, John. I mean, in the worst case scenario, and I mean the worst case scenario, you go and you leave a review and you don't win anything. I mean, if you want to even go as far as like, hey, man, I might win something. Even if I don't want any of this stuff, I'll put it on eBay and sell it. Come on, man. We're like, you know, we're giving you options over here.
Can you delete those?
The options?
No, the reviews.
I don't know if you can or
not.
I just don't
want to like have a bunch of angry people like, they.
Yeah.
One star if they can't. Just be good, man. It's just a gamble, baby.
Yeah.
Take a risk,
have some
fun. You
don't
literally have to write it like out with a pen.
You know, I'm going to go as far as...
It's a written review.
I'm going to go as far as saying that I'll take it if somebody will go on there and like copy and paste a previous review. Go ahead, why not? The review police not going to put you in review jail.
I might. That wouldn't be fair to like our friends who are being honest.
It is a sort of a plagiarism kind of a thing, isn't it?
I'm going to get some lawyers after them.
I think we've probably milked this tangent about as far as it can go. I'm even getting bored with it.
It is really pathetic.
All right, guys. Anyway, we will see you guys on Tuesday, which, again, if you're most of you listening to this on as soon as we post it, that'll be tomorrow. But check our Twitter page, check our Facebook page for some updates. We're going to narrow that time slot down for you. We'll make sure that you guys are well aware of when we're going to do it.
Bored with this. Let's move on.
We're moving on. So, well, we're going to move on to stuff that people really like. We know that you guys like to talk about gear. Man, drummers love gear. And so we decided it's been about 10 episodes or so since we did our first gear-related show, which, John, I'm going to go ahead and pat ourselves on the back and say it was an unabashed success. Man.
Even though people talk about it every day on the forum.
Yeah. They can't get enough of it.
It was well received. So, you know, yeah, we're not original, but it was fun.
Yeah. And so
it's just opinions.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say, we're just going to give you our opinions of what we like. And you never know, it could be one of these things where you guys may not be aware of a few pieces of these gear that we talk about. And at the very least, it gives you a chance to check some of it out so you can kind of hear what we're talking about. Because all this gear that we're going to talk about is stuff that we either currently own and play or have previously owned and played or maybe even used it on some kind of a backline type thing. So in other words, all this stuff that we're talking about is gear tested, real deal, gig tested stuff.
Yes, sir.
So we decided that one of the next most popular pieces of gear from snare drums that guys like to talk about are ride cymbals.
Ooh.
Hence the aforementioned show.
The elusive magic ride that we all search for.
Yeah.
I think it's the hardest cymbal to pick, bar none. And it just...
Over hi-hats?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel way more confident picking hi-hats than ride cymbals. And it's sort of just like finding that sound in your head, man. It's tough.
I think it's the second hardest. I think hi-hats, to me, are the hardest to pick simply from the standpoint that you got to find two cymbals that work together well as opposed to one. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I can actually hear magic hi-hats quicker than I can hear, but I feel like that it's harder to find.
Okay, I can appreciate
magic
that.
Magic hi-hats as opposed to the proverbial magic ride.
I'm going to stick with the ride symbol.
You go with it, man.
I'm still searching, and I've had 4,000 of them. But I think there's something to be said for we think we need to keep searching. Sometimes we might have exactly what we need.
Well, John, I thought what we would do is we would kind of kick this show off talking about a couple things. We'll talk about just some general characteristics of symbols, right? Of ride symbols. And then also, I know that you wanted to also kind of talk a little bit about that our ride symbol choices a lot of times stem from certain trends that are occurring at times. And some of these trends also kind of encapsulate using these iconic drummers from time to time also, and we try to mimic their cymbal sound that fits inside of these trends.
True. Yeah, I've noticed like across the board, just kind of like decade to decade, it seems to change up. And that's just like anything, clothes or drums or sizes, and, you know, it's never ending. And some of it has to do with marketing.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. I mean, I'm not saying that sometimes people come up with a sound, you know.
Well, I mean, if you want to put it in a very broad, general kind of term, if you want to think of it from the standpoint of like jazz, when we think in terms of like these, you might say prototypical or definitive jazz symbols, the first thing that comes to everybody's mind are these drummers that played the old K Zildjians, right? And I mean, still to this day, the majority of most drummers who play that style of music are looking for something that
chasing
is...
chasing it.
Yeah, you're chasing an old K, whether it's an old K or any of these Turkish companies that are making cymbals that are sort of old K copies or old K made in the style of old K Zildjians, right?
No doubt.
So, I mean, you know, some of the iconic cymbal sounds from the day would be like guys trying to find like Art Blakey's old K's, Elvin Jones' old K's, Mel Lewis's old K's. And then you get into a little bit more contemporary style of drumming. You would have even like trying to find that elusive Tony Williams old K. And then if you want to even go into super contemporary stuff, people like Bill Stewart's old K's. They're all old K's, but they all have a little bit of a different vibe, especially for the different kind of eras of the music that we love.
Well, I think there's also something that is overlooked is, you know, touch is a factor.
And of course.
I mean, I might play Elvin cymbals and you might not really be like, they sound okay. Whereas Elvin might sit down and play them and just like, there's nothing better in the world than this.
Well, that's...
So it's kind of... Yeah. It's sort of, it's subjective in some ways, and it's also, while we're searching for that magic thing, I mean, like, I'm a perfect example. I play nothing like Elvin. So does it make sense that I have cymbals that sound like his? I'm more of a Jimmy Cobb, you know, like, are we falling into the hype and the you know, the celebrity, or are we falling into application and how we play it, what sticks we use? There's a lot of factors there.
Do you know what the real psychological magic is, though, behind that? Is, are we, for example, everybody talks about like Art Blakey's old K's on like Moanin', right?
Or as well they should.
Yeah, or let's use Elvin on like Speak No Evil or on Juju or Love Supreme, right? Part of the psychological thing behind that is that I think sometimes you can find an old K that you think sounds like that. Or at least it may not sound like Elvin's old K when you sit them side by side, but maybe your touch on your cymbal makes you think of Elvin's old K. And I think that psychological aspect of it is really what everybody's chasing, is that when your stick hits your K, it reminds you of Elvin's cymbal, or it reminds you of Tony's cymbal.
Well, I can dig that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, then four bars in, I'm like, well, it really sounds like him, but my playing doesn't. So now I'm miserable. I just spent $2,500 on this old K, and I sound like some hack. And
I've been telling you to get rid of those
burlesque show or
those
something.
3S sticks with the huge ball nylon tip, man. That's not doing you any favors.
That's the vibe, man. I'm an idiot. I bought sticks that said Elvin Jones on them, and I still didn't sound like him. I was pissed.
Did you return them and then complain?
Yeah.
Of course, that's going to say, why wouldn't you?
That's false advertising.
Yeah. So, part two of this, let's talk about just some general characteristics of some symbols.
Here, okay.
Okay. Because every one of these general characteristics is going to play a factor into what your symbol sounds like. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. We're just going to kind of go through a list and then give you the bullet points on each one of them. But first and foremost, you have to go from the top and start with how the symbol's constructed. And to me, the delineation point starts with, is it a cast symbol or is it a non-cast symbol? And for those of you folks who are not exactly sure what that means, a cast symbol is... we'll say it's the Turkish style of making symbols, where they actually pour molten bronze into casts and make each symbol individually that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll call the non-casting system, we'll call that the European style, the Swiss style of making symbols, which is the manufacturer purchases sheet bronze and then pretty much cuts the symbols out of the sheet. Each one of those different styles of manufacturing is going to give you a different sound and a different feel. For the most part, I'm going to say, again, this is just opinion, but your Turkish sounding symbols are going to be a little darker, a little more complex, a little warmer. They also are going to be a little softer in feel. We'll call
even volume oftentimes.
Correct, yeah. And the non-cast stamped models will generally be, the first thing I think of, John, is they feel a little stiffer
mm-hmm.
to play. Also, you generally have a tendency to have a little bit of a higher pitch cymbal as well, which a lot of our rock brethren really like those because they have that tendency to, air quotes, cut.
Feel like, yeah.
Yeah.
As I get older, cut really is... way down my list.
Did you like that definition, though?
Yeah, it was good.
It's okay.
Why? Why all of a sudden do you need my affirmation? You've never even, like, my opinions never matter to you.
It's because you're close to me right now.
Dang it.
Yeah.
I'd like you to, when you're home, I want you to call me and ask my opinion about something. It would mean a lot to me.
Yeah, but you're not sitting across the table at that time.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah?
Yeah. I just need... let's move on.
Will you Facebook video with me?
No.
All right. Next thing. The next big thing that will draw the line of demarcation is the style of hammering. John, you got hand hammering, which, again, let's throw that squarely into the park of the Turkish style of making symbols.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. And then you've got machine hammering, which we will call that a hybrid of the European style and then also the American style or North American style of making cymbals. We can think of the hand hammered styles. We'll call those the sort of like the Zildjian K's. We'll call them Sabian HH's. Right, and then the machine hammered, we'll call those maybe like the Zildjian A's and pretty much all of the Paistes.
Yeah.
And a good bit of the Minels also.
Right.
Use machine hammering. And again, like I said, we could sit here and we could talk up an entire podcast on that alone, but we just wanted to give you a generalization there. Then the next thing, John, we've got the mixture of different alloys. And to me, again, this is another very, very, very important thing for sound and feel. For the most part, when you're talking about bronze, you're talking about copper and tin mixed together mm-hmm. makes bronze. In general, the larger amount of tin you have in the symbol, the darker and the softer the metal. The more copper and less tin you have, you generally have a bit of a stiffer cymbal and something that has a little more high pitched, a little more of a silvery kind of a sound.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll kind of give you a few models on those. the symbols that have a little bit less tin and more copper, a lot of times use a formula called a 92-8, 92% copper, 8% tin. Some of the symbols that you might be familiar with would be like the Paiste 2002s. I believe the Meinl Soundcasters also have that. Sabian B8 Pros would have that as well. And I think some of the lower line of the Zildjians have that 92.8. Does that sound right?
None of those sound right to me.
So in other words, John's telling you something there, folks. Read between those lines.
Hey, I want to say, I'd like to propose a new attitude about symbols. I think we should stop saying, man, your brass sounds great.
It's not brass,
it's not
bro.
True.
Yeah.
So stop.
What about
like
pies?
If you're talking about my Black Beauty,
yeah
okay. But cymbals, pies, you know, I don't personally say that, but I'm sort of like, to me, that's almost like just a habit.
What about plates?
Plates. I wouldn't eat off any of my cymbals. They are nasty.
Point taken.
Yeah, so no. But, man, your bronze/tin sounds incredible. I like that.
I don't know, man. Sounds like you're kind of beating around the bush to get somewhere on that, you know?
No,
I'm doesn't
not.
Have quite
I'm
the
just,
zip.
I'm just
yeah.
complaining to complain.
So the next most popular kind or type of alloy would be a B20 mm-hmm. alloy. And I think that most people really kind of relate to those symbols as being like the ultimate sounding symbols, or probably the most characteristic, the most popular symbols. And I think there's also a term, they just call it bell brass
mm-hmm.
for B20 alloy, which is 20% tin and 80% copper.
And brass.
And brass, right.
Or not.
And those symbols would be your K Zildjians, your A Zildjians. For Paiste, that would be like your Formula 602s, some of the sound creations from back in the day. And I believe the Master Series, too, John, might be that. It's either that or it might be the 1585.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the ballpark, though,
yeah,
for sure.
Somewhere in there.
And clearly the recipe that I think is...
Yeah, me too.
Just really...
Far and away, the majority of my symbols are those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
The Meinl Bisons, I think, are also 80-20 bell brass.
That would make sense.
And then there's a few fringe elements of alloy. You've got like that Paiste signature alloy, which is 85-15. They make the signature symbols and the dark energies out of those. And then, John, there's also an even softer in there. There's a 75-25 that a few folks make. I don't really know who makes those, but
Dream
might be 75-25.
Soft.
Yeah. And did old Spitzkino, did he use any of that 75-25, or was it all 80-20?
Man, that stuff's so expensive. I can't even bring myself to research it.
So
I'm going to hear one and like it, and then I'm going to get in trouble with my wife.
Yeah.
So.
And then, John, you got just all the different characteristics of the symbol shape itself. You know,
wait, did he use diamonds in those?
Gold.
Gold?
Yeah.
24 karat gold.
Yeah.
You use like, yeah. What's the rarest form of metal?
I don't know. Is it he might have used like plutonium or something.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Man. Radioactive symbols.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And then, John, the last things we'll talk about, just the actual shape characteristics of the symbol that are naturally going to affect these different sounds. You got, of course, the bell. You got thick bells, thin bells, or thinner bells. Bells are still the on a symbol's the thickest part of the symbol, or it should be, right?
Even the integrated stuff is definitely that.
For the most part, if you got a large bell, you're generally going to have a few more overtones on the cymbal. If you're going to have a thin bell or no bell, you're going to have less overtones and more stick definition.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the actual bow of the cymbal, which is, that would be if you're looking at the profile of the cymbal from the side and you're looking at the profile, the bow is the general curvature cymbal. And in general, if you have a more curved cymbal, you're going to have a slightly higher pitch cymbal. Flatter cymbal, it's going to be a slightly darker cymbal. And then
rings true.
Right. And then you've got thickness of the cymbal. And then, you know, thicker generally means higher pitch. Thinner is going to mean lower pitched. And then lastly, you've got lathing. And boy, there's a zillion different ways to lathe cymbals. Partial lathings, thick lathings, thin lathings, pin lathings. Then you got the whole thing of polishing cymbals where you polish the tonal grooves down and get a brilliant finish. So, I mean, there's a million different things regarding the lathing that will affect the general playability.
Stars.
Yeah. Star lathings? Or hammerings.
I don't know. There was never any lathing on those.
You're showing stars. Your colors now, man. 80s.
Hey.
Yeah. So now that we've kind of covered the general characteristics, let's talk about our picks.
All right.
John, let's do jazz rides first.
Okay. I think this is the hardest ones to
probably
to really
so.
Find.
Do you want to do your first one, or you want me to do the first one?
I'll do mine.
Go for it.
In the lower volume settings, you know, a piano trio, that kind of thing. We both had the luxury of long ago being able to kind of go into the warehouse at Bosphorus when shipments would come in and throw aside the dogs and pick some magic cymbals, and we certainly came up with some. So right now I'm playing a couple masters, definitely the older masters, especially my 19. It's like,
yeah,
just magic, thin, warm. I got rivets in the 19 and actually in the 21 I'm using of yours. It's got a rivet too.
Yeah, it's a 22, by the way.
22. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I don't know why. I had a 21, that's why.
Yeah.
And it got weird on me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. But maybe it just didn't like how I played it, so it said I'm going to sound like crap as time goes on. Anyway, lower volume stuff, you know, you're looking at the 19's like in that 1650 range.
Yeah.
And that 22 is probably in the 19-ish range.
Maybe. Correct, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Good stuff for that. I like a little more spread because my technique blows, so I get a little more of that than maybe some guys. Then in the little more higher volume, aggressive, straight-ahead thing, like you're at, you know, a club or something, you're blowing it out, hard bop kind of thing. I have a couple nice ones, a 20-inch Corot that is kind of cool. A little more spread than I wish, but still it works.
Quick side note, man. Have you noticed that there are a lot of similarities between, like, the profile bell shape and everything of those Corots and the Master Series?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
It's probably why I like them.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a 20-inch Istanbul Agop Traditional that is a little drier, a little more definition than that Corot, so I kind of treat them as like the Istanbul is the main ride, and then that Corot that opens up a little more is my left side.
Yeah.
Just enough contrast in them that it works, but loud enough that, you know, you're going to hear them. I think that's something that can be overlooked. Like, I love those really thin masters, but man, sometimes they just get lost.
It's been my experience with those since, and especially even the 22 that you're borrowing of mine right now, is that with any cymbal,
borrowing,
we'll say you've acquired it.
Right.
How about that?
That's good
for now. Okay. I've always thought a little bit of a trade-off on those cymbals. For the most part, most of the Master Series have a medium to a medium small bell and kind of a flat profile.
Right.
All right. That in itself inherently, when you're doing that, it will lower the pitch of the cymbal, and with it also having a smaller bell will kind of decrease some of the overtones.
Volume as well.
Yeah, and the volume.
Yep.
And they kind of, to give you a little bit of spread underneath, it made those cymbals thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little bit of a trade-off. You have to be careful with those a little bit.
Definitely.
That if you lay into them too much, you can overpower your stick definition.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I'll tell you, that 22 that you've got, That sucker, man, went all over the world with me, man. That thing's been everywhere. I played that on a lot of piano trio gigs, man.
It's great for that.
Works awesome for that.
And especially, like, you know, like, again, man, I like harp on my inability to do that. But, like, in those settings, you know, I'm able to comfortably play soft, you know, when needed to just pick it up a little bit. It doesn't get away from you volume-wise. And so I really love them for that, you know. Like,
yeah,
they accommodate my abilities really well in some settings that can be challenging.
Yeah. John, did that close out your jazz rides there?
Yeah, we don't need to go any further because I play them about twice a year. Right. So I can't really elaborate on them that much.
So I have got three then as well that I'll talk about. And actually, one of them is dangerously close to one of yours as far as like left side ride goes.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with main rides or right side rides. The first one I'm going to talk about is a 22-inch Matt Bettis hardtop ride. Now, for those of you folks who are not familiar, Matt is a California-based cymbalsmith, and he makes some mighty fine brass, right, John?
He does.
Yeah.
Just got an ear for really...
He really does.
...honing into whatever he's working on.
And I like to think I have a magic cymbal of his. To be quite honest, I am a huge fan of what I'll call his pre-Sabian cymbals, because he has been using Sabian blanks for, I guess, the better part of 2 to 3 years now. And I bought a pre-Sabian Matt Bettis cymbal that is just, man, it's just absolutely magic. I mean, it's just...
Do you know what those blanks were?
No idea. It could be Wuhan.
Yeah, I know someone who's working on cymbals right now that got, a pretty reasonable price, got some Wuhan stuff.
Yeah, this cymbal is just, it's magic all around, man. I mean, it really is. It to me, here we go, going through our what I think it sounds like. To me, it sounds like an old Mel Lewis cymbal.
Tough to beat.
Yeah, and it sounds better to me than the Istanbul Mel Lewis cymbals.
Yeah, those are ridiculously inconsistent, too.
Right.
Like any Turkish cymbal is. Like that Bosphorus thing, man. How many did we play that were just...
Hundreds that went to the pile.
You get vertigo.
Yeah.
Especially when there's a new shipment, you're just like...
Your ears burn out.
Totally.
Yeah. But yeah, I got this... I acquired this Matt Bettis 22-inch hardtop ride a few years ago. And it's got a nice, low, dark pitch. It's got a large bell. It's got a rather large bell, man, for that size cymbal. And it's, of course, a very well-integrated bell that just sounds great, man, when you have to play like those different Latin grooves that might use it, like mambos and that sort of thing. It's got the best thing that I can describe as far as like the ping sound. It's got a real woody slap to it. You got lots of undertones underneath it, but boy, that woody slap really comes out.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a great sound and cymbal. Fully hammered bell. It's got a really cool lathing on it. It's got one little strip around the bell of unlathed metal.
Oh, yeah. I've seen some of his stuff like that.
Yeah, really
like
cool.
Like a racing stripe.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And overall, it's just a cymbal that blends really well, man. I've used it in quartet, trios. I've even recorded a little bit of rock stuff with it. Sounds good.
I won't tell him.
Now, here, the next cymbal that I'm going to talk about is actually very, very similar to the Bettis cymbal. The thing is, you know, every Bettis cymbal is pretty much one of a kind.
Definitely.
And this next cymbal that I'm going to talk about is not one of a kind. It's one that you can find relatively easily. And the consistency of these cymbals is pretty darn good from what I can tell. And that is a 22-inch K Constantinople bounce ride. Now you're probably going, well, that's a Zildjian, and you're talking about a one-of-a-kind, you know, type cymbal with the Bettis. Well, here's where I'm going with this. This bounce ride that Zildjian makes is actually a copy of one of Mel Lewis's cymbals that he gave to Kenny Washington back in the mid-70s. Yeah. And again, it's also the infamous cymbal that we've talked about on the show before that I actually had for a little while that Kenny let me have.
I remember.
Yeah. And the everything I said about the Bettis cymbal pretty much goes for this bounce ride as well. Very, very similar. It's got that little bit of a large bell. It's got nice dark undertones with a woody stick slap. Relatively same medium thin sort of weight.
What is the weight of it?
I don't know.
What?
I don't know, man. Let me tell you. The weight was actually on the ad for that Bettis cymbal, but I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's written under the bell. Probably is written under the bell.
I would guess so.
Yeah.
You don't know what the bounce ride is?
Mm-mm. Nope.
Man, that's not cool in this day and age.
I know.
You're getting judged heavily right now.
Man, I'm going to say that...
Hang your head.
Yeah, both of these cymbals are going to be in the low 2000s.
Yeah, I was going to say 22, 23-ish.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because they're still, you know, when you get up into 24, 25, there's a little more definition.
Yeah. I'm going to say that it's probably somewhere in that 22 to 23.
That would be a good guess.
Yeah, is where it is. So anyway, yeah, if you folks want to look at something that is close to that Bettis, but again, like I said, it's one of those things that you're just not going to be able to find it in a Bettis. Look toward the Zildjian K Constantinople bounce ride.
It's more readily available.
Oh, it is a delicious symbol, man. It really is.
I want to check those out.
Do yourself a solid. Check it out. And then my third symbol, we'll call it my left side ride. This is my go-to left side ride. And it actually, John, was paired with that 22 that you are borrowing or that you have acquired from me right now. That has
Will you say that one more time?
Acquired from me.
Documented.
Yeah. And it has traveled the road many, many times. And it is a 19-inch.
You played that with the long-winded biography guy named Ramon Pouza, right?
I have. Yeah. Many, many. Hundreds of times, yes.
Joe's still, like, wrecked over that, man. You told me to keep it short and sweet, and then you went on and on and on about Ramon.
How about on Facebook Live Tuesday, we give you a second shot at that?
I mean, look, man. I don't even like that guy, so I don't care. I just...
Documented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like him. I'm kidding.
Can I continue, sir?
Sorry.
All right. So the symbol that I'm talking about is a 19-inch Bosphorus traditional ride. Okay? So the biggest difference between these traditional symbols and the Masters have to do with the traditional symbols are made with a slightly more traditional profile and bell size. The bells are a little bit larger. The profile is a slightly more curved, which those two things combined will raise the pitch of the cymbal a tad bit, all right? Which is kind of what you're looking for when you're looking for a left side ride. You got a darker, lower pitched right side main ride. Left side ride, slightly higher pitched with a little bit more of a present bell. Right. And so I really like that symbol a lot. I still use it, like I said, in pairing with the Bettis symbol. It sounds perfect to me when you use that bell on like the Poinciana groove. One of the artists that I did some road work with, he had a song that he had a tune that he had written that he basically said, we're going to play the Poinciana groove over this tune, you know, and it just works beautifully for that. So it's got a great bell sound. And also, there's something about the pitch of that cymbal being a little bit higher that it fits and sits perfectly with like a bass solo. Nice. Stays out of the frequency of the bass player.
Yeah, man.
It's really nice for that.
That's true, man. It can get really soupy with a big, dark 22.
Mm-hmm.
I always go out and go that route when I'm backing up a bass.
A drummer or a bassist that shall go unmentioned.
Yeah, because I rarely back up any bassists that are playing solos. So it's easier to keep it at that.
So there you go, folks. There's our choices, I should say, for our jazz slash low volume cymbals. John, you want to talk about some higher volume cymbals, rock pop stuff?
Yeah. One thing I mentioned that I have been using more and more. I kind of call it my hybrid ride.
Yeah.
And it's kind of for those lower volume groove gigs, and you know, like maybe you're playing like some R&B-ish stuff, but it's not real heavy-handed and all that. And, I have a 21-inch Istanbul traditional that it's kind of in that 24-ish range.
Yeah.
2350 maybe. And it's a great one in that it's kind of got that Steve Jordan-esque sort of vibe. It's like you hear it, but it's like you almost feel it as much as you hear it sort of thing.
Yeah.
In the context of a groove.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess you could use it on straight ahead stuff, but I like it more in that. I kind of hear it like that Jordan kind of vibe. And it's a cool symbol for that lower volume and hybrid kind of gigs where you might be doing a little bit of everything, not at an intense volume or anything. And it works. It's a cool symbol, like a good one to have laying around, you know, have something like that.
It's a little bit of a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah. Yep. Most definitely. It can hang in a number of settings.
One of mine's going to be that too. Kind of Swiss Army knife. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Got another one over there?
I do, man. Yeah. I have one of the cymbals I never, ever let go of is just a straight up 20-inch K from the late 90s. We were talking about, you know, the newer ones have less lathing.
Right.
Circular lathing. This one has a little more of that. So in the 90s, they had a little more of that almost A-like lathing, but still hammered it. And weights were a little less, and this one's like kind of in that 2200 range. And man, I use it on that corporate gig. It's not pingy in any annoying way. There's enough weight to it; it can be heard, but it's not like a heavy A or something like that. That's the one I have of all the cymbals I have. That one I probably play the most. As crazy as it is, just.
And John, the model on that, it just says Ride.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's just a magic little cymbal. I found it at a Mars Music of all places. Just got lucky.
Probably got it for nothing too, didn't you?
It was pretty cheap.
Yeah.
But it's been with me for almost 20 years.
Man, right on.
Yeah, man.
All right. Good one. Now, to piggyback off of your Swiss Army knife, my Swiss Army knife, which is a relatively new acquisition. I've had it only about a year, but I really like it. I've been using a 22-inch A Avidus series.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, which is one of those. How long has that cymbal series been around? A year and a half?
Maybe.
Yeah, something like that. So I got it when I was a fairly early adopter of that cymbal. And they are readily available, folks, and they are very consistent too, which is really nice.
No doubt about
these cymbals. So if you like what I'm going to say about this one, get online, listen to a few of them, and run down to your store and check them out also. These cymbals,
those hi-hats too.
Are all of the cymbals, man, yeah, in that line great. Are very good.
They did it right.
These cymbals are supposed to be throwbacks to like 1950s and 60s A Zildjians. So they are slightly thinner and have a slightly different hammering and lathing style and a different sort of profile on the cymbal as well. And the thing that is probably the most marked difference, aside from these being a little bit thinner, and John, I believe, man, that the 22 that I've got, I believe the weight on that thing is 2190.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's fairly thin for a 22.
Kind of in that sweet ride range.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things you'll notice about it is that when the cymbal tapers toward the edge has a fairly pronounced little flange.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Downward. Yeah. And that in itself, I think, aside from raising the pitch of a cymbal that's fairly thin, also probably helps control a little bit of the overtones.
Yeah, I would see that being the case.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, one of the things that I really like about those Avidus series, the bell. Oh, the bell is delightful, John.
Good to hear.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the separated laser-like bell. It's got an integrated bell that I think it fits really nicely in virtually every style of music. And I've been using this cymbal a whole bunch of different ways. I actually took it out on a trio gig. Yeah, and really liked it. Let me tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of, if any of you guys out there have heard any of those old, now they're old, mid to late 90s crisscross records that Joe Farnsworth, New York drummer, played on. It sounded to me like Farnsworth was using a lot of old A's on those recordings.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah, and I think Lewis Nash also back then used a good bit of old A's on some of the, it sounds like those cymbals.
Our friend Wayne Vier calls, he said, if I ever started a cymbal line, I would call them Brown Customs.
Yeah.
Because he has some 60s A's he likes, and I was laughing. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what A of Edis is. They're a little darker hue. And
Cool. I think initially some people, when you play and lay into those cymbals a little bit, think that the stick sound kind of gets away from you a little bit. But here's kind of a unique thing about this. I actually, on one of my gigs, there's a dedicated sound guy, setup roadie guy. I will have him from time to time play while I go out front and listen to stuff through the system. And I was like, man, lay into that cymbal a little bit and let me kind of hear what it sounds like. Man, even in a loud volume situation with somebody laying into it, you don't lose the stick. You hear a nice bit of stick definition in
there.
That's
good. And not too much.
Right.
Which is appealing.
Yeah, and also that cymbal works really well, man, if you want to just wash that thing out.
Shank it.
Yep, shank it. Get that mercy beat kind of sound that Steve Jordan likes to talk about, you know?
It's not mercy beat. It's Coldplay.
Okay.
Come on.
Coldplay beat.
It's contemporary Christian, man.
Yeah, but that cymbal has to be like a 26-inch cymbal then.
Well, yeah, you're probably right.
Man, if the bass drum diameter and ride cymbal diameter don't add up to over 50 inches, you ain't cutting it, baby.
Okay.
I'm just...
Fine.
Man, I'm stating the truth here.
I'm bringing... The next church gig I do, I'm bringing 12-inch special recording hats and a 16-inch, like...
Flat ride.
medium... No, 16-inch medium A... Which is one of the worst sounding cymbals ever. That's what I'm going to use. But like, what's up, boy?
Check out my vibe. Man, you might start a new trend.
I'm afraid of that.
Yeah. So, John, my second cymbal I want to talk about, going back to the Bosphorus playbook, man, I have got a 22 Bosphorus Gold Series Heavy. That's the only designation. It's a gold heavy.
It's honest, too, isn't it?
It is. It is honest, man. Again, I don't know. I don't know the gram weightings, but it's up there on this one.
35-ish?
I don't know if it's that heavy, man. You're getting into, like, the deep ride heaviness on that. But it's up there.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, Bosphorus did, to me, a wonderful thing with that Gold Series. Those were still hand-hammered cymbals. They buff those lathing grooves down to give you some brilliance on it. But, man, there's plenty of dark, warm undertones underneath it. Love that cymbal.
That was kind of reminding me, most of them I played were kind of reminded of like some of the better lower-pitched A Customs, that kind of vibe.
Also, man, you know what? I got a vibe of early American K.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, on some of those as well.
That makes sense.
Yeah, early American K on some of it. Because, you know, they were...
For way less money.
For way less money. And, you know, also, man, there were not a whole lot, but there were a fair amount of brilliant early American Ks.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Wow, they were hideous, though.
Yeah.
Those were, man, I haven't played a lot of early American Ks that I like, to be honest with you. There's like, everybody's like, oh, they're so great. And I'm like, eh.
To me, that they suffered a little bit of the Bosphorus stigma that you had to go through a bunch.
Totally.
To get good ones.
Yeah.
You know, but let me tell you, I had a good one that I ended up selling. I had a 20 that I ended up selling to somebody. And then, man, I was...
Bread, not that great.
And then, man, I've known a couple of guys that had some early American Ks, man, that sounded really good.
Oh, there were some. I mean, Tony had some that were great.
Yeah.
You know, like they had pick of the litter, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I remember a few other people playing those.
But yeah, this Gold Series Bosphorus, man, it had a really pronounced ping that was kind of surrounded by some dark undertones. So it wasn't too dry.
Mm-hmm.
Had a nice ping in there. The Achilles heel of that cymbal, in my opinion, is the bell. Since it is a thick cymbal, that bell is pretty separated. And it's got a little bit of laser-like qualities, which is just, to me, man, it just doesn't sound right. It cuts too much through cymbals or through bands. And then the other thing, man, I've recorded a few times with that cymbal, and I've learned some of the tendencies of it. And every time I record with it now, if I feel like it's a song that needs that kind of vibe, I always put some moon gel or moleskin or something underneath that bell, because there's a little bit of a tendency for it to have a kind of a standing high wave pitch that can sometimes ride out on that cymbal.
Yep.
But if I can tame it down a little bit, the ride sound on that cymbal is really, really nice, man. Very, very nice.
You could put that blanket on it.
Has that ever been done before?
No. Just being a smart ass.
So anyway, those are my two choices of rock pop cymbals that I really like, and I think they're different enough, man, that they fit the bill for pretty much anything you'd want to do for rock, pop, country, modern country, that sort of thing.
Yep. There's definitely, you can't get too trendy and cute with some of that stuff. And,
yeah,
you know, like some 2,100 gram dark hand hammered cymbal is like, I'm over here, I promise. Trust me, I'm here. But
yeah,
you got to trust it.
So, John, moving on, we have a little, we'll call it an honorable mentioned or special secret weapon set of cymbals.
Mm-hmm.
You got a couple of those you want to talk about?
None at all. I'm a boring old traditionalist in that sense.
Was there any other cymbals though you wanted to talk about, or did we exhaust your
19 inch China Boy low? Kidding. Our credibility of the show just went in the toilet.
Well, I've got a couple.
I know you do. Yeah. You have some good ones.
Yeah, I got a couple, and won't spend a whole lot of time on these. The first one that I want to talk about is a Paiste Formula 602 flat ride. When I think of flat ride, that is the symbol.
That's a good one. Proven over to be the one.
That's it. I mean, if I'm going to play a flat ride, that's going to be it. I mean, it's just, to me, that's the flat ride. Is a Paiste Formula 602. Case in point, you've heard it on Chick Corea, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs. That's what Roy Haynes played on there, and I believe Chick Corea still owns that cymbal. Virtually any Pat Metheny record from 1975 up until when Wertico left the band, you've heard that cymbal a million times on there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's just this wonderful, glassy, silvery, deliciously pingy cymbal. I mean, it's just for the style of music, especially that Metheny writes, man, it's hand in glove. It's as important as his sound on his guitar.
I agree.
You know? So that's one, is if you're thinking flat rides, folk, you probably are not going to get any better than that. And then the last one that I want to talk about, for a while, John, I made this one of my go-to rock pop rides. And it is...
Until you got an offer you couldn't refuse?
Yeah.
I hate those.
Yeah.
Dang.
But let me tell you, if the right situation presented itself, I would go right back. And it is a Paiste Master Series 24-inch... Yes, I said that, John. Deep ride. It is the heaviest cymbal, bar none.
You're still safe. You won't be called by any churches now.
Yeah.
It's heavy.
Yeah, it's bar none the heaviest cymbal that I ever owned.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you want to just get past the whole silliness of thousands of grams, that thing's weighed about 10 pounds, this cymbal. It was kind of unique in that Peisty line that it was made with like an 80-20 style alloy. And to my understanding, it was pretty much all hand-hammered, heavily hand-hammered. Heavily, heavily, heavily hand hammered, which made it also easily the darkest Peisty cymbal I've ever made, ever owned and played. And also,
it's almost an oxymoron.
Yeah. And man, the stick definition on that was just, it was unbeatable. Ha, 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 ha. Right? No pun in, or pun intended. The stick definition on it was incredible, but it was, again, surrounded by a lot of dark undertones. So it was not just like hitting a manhole cover. Wasn't like that at all. John, you played on that cymbal.
Yeah. It was the weirdest cymbal I've ever played. Not in a bad way. Just in like everything you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
It kind of just took a left turn and be like, what just happened?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I disliked most about that cymbal was the bell. Again, it was a separated bell. And again, that comes with the badge when you're dealing with a 10-pound cymbal. I mean, come on, man.
You're not going to find bells that are appealing in those circumstances.
Or at least to me, it's not. Let me say this. If you guys like dark cymbals with separated bells and it's pingy, just run straight to the drum store right now and take out a loan because that cymbal cost about $1 million if you have to buy it. MSRP. Isn't that about a $700 cymbal somewhere in that ballpark?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, I didn't pay anywhere even close to that. But it's a good cymbal for what it is, man. That's his John Robinson cymbal, man. This guy named, he's played on a couple of records, man. He lives out in California. You may not have heard of him.
Nah.
Yeah. But it's his cymbal, and you know, since he does a session every now and then, I figured that it would probably record.
Might have some redeeming qualities.
Yeah. So anyway,
I'll have to look him up.
That's my two honorable mentions.
Very nice, man.
We're done with that.
That's cool. The one thing that clearly everyone is aware of, and in some ways affected by, is, especially with ride cymbals, man, this trends are really, really a big factor.
Oh, yeah.
We've been around a long time. So, you know, in the 80s, it was just heavy and pingy. It couldn't be heavy enough or pingy enough with a bell that would, you know, go through your brain like an arrow.
And, man, that actually permeated all the way into, like, fusion stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, if the two big players at that time that everybody, of course, wanted to be was Weckl.
Dennis.
Well, and Dennis, yeah. And, man,
Earthride.
Earthride, and then Weckl was using those K Customs, man, which were just awful sounding, if you ask me.
Hi, Dave.
Isn't he coming on the show next week?
No. Was then you get kind of into that 90s and 2000s thing. It was more of like a sort of that medium but a little bit darker and crashable thing, and of course now it's like
thinner the better, baby.
It started kind of with the Jordan and like Ronnie from the Killers, bigger and darker and all that, and that's been a big thing. But look, man, just trust that sound in your head for your vibe. Go out and find those. It's difficult to find ride cymbals, I think.
Yeah.
I'm convinced I'm still searching all the time, which in some ways has been created by these trends and these, you know, iconic cymbals. But at the same time, it's not bad to be searching for things like that because that really gives you your thing, versus we can all go buy a Black Beauty or we can all go buy a, you know, old Ludwig kit, and there's going to be kind of some limitations on what that vibe's going to be. But ride cymbals are definitely something you can kind of have really define your thing. And don't quit searching if you haven't found it, man. It's it's a fun, I think it's a fun hunt.
Oh, it's awesome.
Frustrating,
man.
At yeah. times, but for the most part, fun. And then you end up with, as we do, you know, some choices, which is good. If you're a working player, you're going to probably want to have some different voices to draw from.
You know, John, one thing I want to say that directly relates to what you're talking about, when you're on the hunt, you know, for these, you know, be-all, end-all symbols, mm-hmm. something I think that is really, really, really important. When you're going to listen to a symbol at a store or wherever, going to somebody's house to check out symbols that might be selling some stuff, make sure that you take your symbols with you as well, especially mm-hmm. the ones you're going to try to pair them with. It is uncanny how close your ear can relate these symbols to one another. From the standpoint, I used to do it all the time, that I would think that I wanted to get a different sounding symbol, and I'd go into a store and I'd play on a symbol and I would buy it and I'd get it home and it sounded like the other symbol.
It's unbelievable how that happens.
Yeah. And so take your existing symbols, in particular, for whatever reason, whether you're trying to get one that sounds like it or mm-hmm. you're trying to get one that doesn't sound like it.
Good advice.
Yeah.
I think also there's two things that help a great deal. One is, I don't really think you can connect with the true essence of a symbol if it's sitting amongst 30 other symbols on a wall.
Yeah.
I don't think that is a real good way. Pull it, try to get it pulled down and play it off. If you can play it with a kit, it really makes a huge difference.
Man.
So, man, when you're talking about this kind of investment, especially when you're getting into some of the higher end stuff, try to go somewhere where you're allowed to do those things if possible.
There are very few retailers out there that wouldn't allow you to A, bring your symbols in, and then B, take their symbols and put them on a kit and play them.
Yeah.
It's such a difficult business, retail, mm-hmm. that, you know, they're going to bend over backward for you to try to accommodate you. So yeah.
If you're not, you're dying a quick death.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You hear that? Retailers?
John's coming for you.
I'm coming for you.
All right, man. So we're going to finish off today. We're going to have our underrated drummer segment of the week.
Yeah, I love it.
Got a couple good ones, man.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
You want me to do mine?
Sure.
My first guy, or my guy, I should say, this week, is the criminally underrated Alan Dawson. And he is underrated in two separate categories, sir. I mean, two separate categories. He is solidly underrated. And I'm going to absolutely plead my case in front of the court right here.
Break it open.
Yeah. I'm going to say that people who know this name are going to first know him as an educator and secondarily as a player. And I'm going to say that he's underrated on both levels. And here's what I'm going to say about this, okay? First off, let me read a list of the hacks that this guy taught. By the way, let me go ahead and say this. Alan Dawson he died in the mid-90s. He was a Boston-based drummer, and he was one of the first faculty members at Berklee School of Music. He started in the late 50s, and he became a star teacher up there. And
Forever,
yeah. He quit in the 70s sometime up there. He just did his own private practice. But let me read you a list of a few of the hacks that this guy taught.
Oh, boy.
You ever heard of a guy named Tony Williams?
No.
Yeah, me either. Vinnie Colaiuta, Steve Smith.
Pizza maker.
Yeah. John Robinson, Casey Sherrill, Terry Lynn Carrington, and this guy that happens to also be the chair of the drum department at Berklee right now, a guy named John Ramsey.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a few of these no-names that Alan Dawson taught while he was in Boston.
Shaped into being the weekend warriors they are.
Yeah.
Incredible. What
just
a list.
Basement drummers, these guys are.
Yeah. You know? But, you know, you got to start somewhere.
Now, let me tell you why, aside from, if that's not enough to say that you're not an underrated teacher, virtually every drummer who has picked up a pair of drumsticks has had some sort of brush with his methodology. If you have done any work at all out of the syncopation book, whether you realize it or not, you are working on some of Alan Dawson's, we'll call them systems for working on syncopation. The same thing with stick control. There's a whole separate methodology of stick control other than opening up the book and sitting down with the snare drum and working on those first few pages. Those first few pages, he has different systems of working on those melodically, separating the lefts and rights between the left hand and right foot on the bass drum, left foot on the hi-hat, right hand on the cymbal, that sort of thing. There's a whole methodology on that. I would dare to say that 90% of most drummers have worked on his methodology without even, or 90% have worked on it, and probably half of them don't realize that he is responsible for them working on it. That guy is a giant in percussion pedagogical methodology. Boy, there's your 50-cent term of the week, isn't it? I mean, you know, I'm looking smarter than I really am, John.
Yeah, that was a big word, man.
Like that?
I thought that was like, had to do with like ministers or something.
Well, you do have to be ordained.
Alan Dawson is ordained.
He is,
in
man.
My book.
Yeah. And then we haven't even gotten to his... He's got a whole rudimental ritual, is what it's called, that basically is a melodic way of working on all of our 40 rudiments, plus there's some extended hybrid rudiments that he's thrown in there, too, if you want to do that. And then on top of that, he primarily did it with brushes. Because, I mean, you know, the philosophy is if you can play rudiments with brushes and get articulation and definition out of that, playing them with sticks is pretty easy, right?
Well, I got to take your word for it. Now,
John, we're going to work on pataflaflas as soon as I hit the stop button on here.
Neato. Let's now. I'm ready for that 4-hour show now.
Yeah. Facebook Live on Tuesday. John's
going
to play pataflaflas.
Keep going. Keep talking. Yeah.
All right, and then one other thing I want to say about his pedagogical stuff is that aside from creating and adapting these books into his methodology, that it was never intended to be used that way. I'm going to say that his systems for how he worked on both stick control and syncopation was a direct influence on another methodology that we commonly use that has been talked about on the show. Even on our very first episode, we talked about Gary Chester and the New Breed. The New Breed essentially is the straight eighth note version of essentially what Alan Dawson did with swing stuff out of the syncopation book, where essentially Gary Chester took a whole series of different straight eighth note rock pop independence exercises using eighth notes, quarter notes, 16th notes, and then had you read these melodies or these reading lines inside of these systems. So I'd have to think that Gary Chester was directly influenced by that as well. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I mean, if that's not enough to tell you that he is a criminally underrated educator, he should be on the Mount Rushmore. He should be mentioned in the same breaths as the guys who wrote the books, George Lawrence Stone, Ted Reed. Just go down the list of those, Jim Chapin. Alan Dawson's face has to be on that Mount Rushmore of pedagogical masters, sir. Now,
thank you.
Yeah, part two of this. He may even be more underrated as a player. In fact, most people have probably never heard this guy play before. He's got a discography of things that he's done, but he was never a part of we'd call them like a definitive rhythm section. He was never a Philly Joe Jones in a Miles rhythm section, or a Tony in a Miles rhythm section, or an Elvin in a Coltrane rhythm section. But there's a couple things I think that's kind of unique about him. One thing was Alan was a technical master of the instrument. Hence, that's what made him also a very good teacher, and he's a very good communicator. But he was one of the first guys who played in trio, quartet, and quintet settings that really played with extreme precision. He was a little bit of a forerunner of a lot of the guys that we think of today that play with this incredible precision, like Bill Stewart and Brian Blade and Ari Honig, these guys that play this almost perfectly metronomic time and just clean comping, clean solo ideas, all that good stuff.
Anything they hear, they execute. Yeah.
Execute flawlessly. Alan Dawson was like that. I call
those the guys who make me laugh.
Yeah.
I'll be listening to them and just start laughing.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But if you will go back and listen to some of the recordings that he was on, he did quite a few with Booker Irvin. He did some with Jackie Byard. He was also in Brubeck's quartet for a short amount of time, but wasn't on any of those landmark recordings.
Right.
I think he was in,
before Joe?
I think he was after. He was after Joe. He was in the early 70s, I believe, with Brubeck. I want to talk also about, I want to give everybody a couple of recordings, and I'll put them up on our infamous Lonely YouTube channel. I want to talk about a couple of tracks that he played on that are very different. One is from earlier in his career. One is from in the latter stages of his career. And both of them are equally fantastic. One I want everybody to check out. He did a few recordings with Sonny Stitt, great saxophonist. And the record was called Tune Up. And the track is called I Got Rhythm. It's just the old I Got Rhythm, Rhythm Changes song. And it's a really cool version of it because it starts out in like this halftime kind of a lope, backbeat-oriented kind of a thing, and then it just goes into a double-time, blistering tune. And it's the kind of thing, it's also one of those tunes where Sonny Stitt, he plays the first half of the tune on tenor saxophone, and then Barry Harris does a piano solo, and then Sonny Stitt picks up an alto saxophone and does a whole nother solo and never repeats a note, never repeats an idea.
Because like, I can.
Yeah, it's like a 9-10 minute song, you know, version of it, and he's just blistering. And the thing I want everybody to listen to is that Alan Dawson on this track does not solo, but he is so brilliant on this track that when he backs up Sonny Stitt on the first part of it, when he's playing tenor saxophone, he plays completely differently on the second solo when Sonny is playing alto saxophone. Different cymbal, different comping ideas, just a different vibe. It's like using it, just playing with a totally different person. Crazy. And it's brilliant. No soloing on that. Mm-hmm. Just playing great sound and great feeling time. All right, so that's Alan Dawson playing on Sonny Stitt's Tune Up album, I Got Rhythm. And then the second one I want to talk about is from later part of his career. It's from the late 80s. It's from a Donald Brown record called The Sweetest Sounds. And the track in particular is the title track called The Sweetest Sounds. He does a series of fours in this tune that are some of the most creative, mind-bending, chops-laden, yet musical fours you'll ever hear. So I'm going to throw that one up there as well.
Please do.
And let everybody hear it. So that's my guy, Alan Dawson, and I'm sticking to it.
Did he play with Oscar?
I don't think so.
Okay. I don't know why that was in my brain.
You know what, though? Let me say this, though. Alan Dawson was one of those guys that once he pseudo-retired from Berkeley, like in the 70s, he stayed in Boston pretty much exclusively. And I think he was kind of the go-to guy when anybody came through town and
house
needed
gig kind of thing.
He was kind of the house drummer for virtually everyone that came through Boston that needed to hire a rhythm section.
Right.
So he probably did at one time or another.
I don't know why that was. He would have been in a great fit for it.
Of course.
For Oscar.
He's pretty much a good fit with anybody.
Yeah. Well, man, you were pretty excited about that guy.
Alan Dawson, man. I mean, like I said, he should be on the Mount Rushmore of drumming.
I'm really excited about my pick, but I it may sound like I'm not after that tribute of joy and awe.
I'm excited, man, though, just to know what you've got.
Well, you should be excited about Alan. That guy's, he's just as dedicated and as giving and as musical as they can come, man.
I went further on that than I actually wanted to, by the
way. That's okay, so, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Your turn.
Oh, okay. Me? My guy is someone who, you know, certainly is not underrated in that you're not going to recognize him or anything like that. He's got a track record that is that anybody would be glad to have. But I just think, at least in my, you know, as far as drummers who really moved me, man, this is a guy that we don't talk about enough, that for a bunch of reasons we should. And it's a Nashville session drummer, Greg Morrow. And
Memphis.
Yeah, that's where we could start.
Yeah.
I think that certainly is a big part of the appeal. He's just got that kind of underlying Memphis R&B DNA that no matter what he's playing, and I've seen him in some settings where it was just kind of more straight ahead rock stuff and all that, but there's just something in there that kind of like New Orleans drummers, there's just something in that thread of players that you just, the magic, and Memphis kind of has that too. But anyway, you know, he's been in Nashville for a long time. He's done a lot of stuff, man. He's like, you know, in the more modern day, he's done all that Luke Bryan stuff and a bunch of that Blake Shelton stuff. So he's on the radio a lot. Sugarland, he did the majority of that stuff. But man, he's done, you know, he's played with a lot of the country legends too, like Reba and Garth, Brooks and Dunn, Leanne Rimes, kind of more in that outlying rebel stuff. He did a lot of the Steve Earle stuff, which, you know, people really, really dig. And there's some of just that organic and just earthy and probably not a click, you know, like yeah. He just has a really good handle on all that. You know, on top of that, he's played with some real legends, man. Joe Cocker, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Joe Bona, whatever his name is, that is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Bonamassa.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's smart enough to use Greg. And just, man, this guy's got, he's just got that grease factor that is, in a lot of the Nashville guys, great players, but I just don't think they have that greasy thing that Greg brings to some of that, and that I think that keeps him working.
Everything I've heard him on me sounds great.
Incredible. The stuff that really, where I really discovered him was on that Dixie Chicks stuff, those first couple records.
Yeah.
That is some incredible drumming, man. Like the feel, the vibe, the sound. And he's a real gearhead too, man. He's like a huge vintage collection, so he draws on, you know, a lot of stuff that really ties into his whole underlying, you know, old school influenced in some ways, greasy R&B, clearly through the thread of his playing. But he's got a great handle on sounds too, which a lot of drummers we like that have some of that really have it. You know, Al Jackson, Steve Jordan, you know, they just really are, you know, Hawkins, they really had it together with sound, and that's something that I think Greg has too. Another record that I remember, just, I'm a big Sonny Landreth fan, and he was on that record South of I-10, which kind of elevated Sonny as a solo artist in a way. Not that he's just blown up, but a lot of people kind of, you know, even though he's played with Hyatt and some of the New Orleans stuff and all that, that record kind of was his coming out party in a way, and Greg's all on a lot of that. Just a man, I just his playing resonates with me in just a big way, and I think it would behoove you to take the time to go back and dig in on the discography and realize, man, this dude is a bad cat.
When I was in Memphis, he had already left. He had already gone to Nashville.
Yeah, he's been there for quite a while.
Long time, man. Yeah. Probably 30 years, I would say.
That sounds right.
But his legend was around.
How could it not be?
And especially anytime you went into any of those studios over there, you know, people were well aware of him and, you know, talked about his prowess in the studio at that time. So, yeah, he's definitely, man, one of those guys that if you know about him.
If you don't, you should.
That's why he's on this show.
Yep, he is a bad cat. Dig in on that, and you will undoubtedly agree. So, Greg, thank you. I love it, man. You're as far as Nashville guys, you're my favorite. So there.
You know what's my favorite? This show.
Really?
This is my favorite show, John.
Man, this is groundbreaking. Incredible. We have found new joy in Phil.
Man, we got to talk about gear. Everybody's going to be happy listening to this.
True.
And then, of course, we'll get some nasty emails. Can't believe you chose that symbol and you left this one out.
What is wrong with you people?
Anyway, I thought I had a great time. I thought it was good.
I loved it, man. I love ride symbols. Love them.
I just love symbols, man.
Yeah, that too.
The joy of finding some good ones.
Man, they're out there.
Yeah.
Be patient. You're going to find what you're looking for.
John, before we head out and before we make our final little salutations and pleads for reviews and whatnot, I do want to draw attention to the great Kim Plainfield, New York and Boston-based drummer that we lost earlier this week.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it was an unexpected loss. But Kim, for those who are not familiar with Kim, again, another underrated drummer, I think most people would probably know him from his educational forays. He wrote several highly regarded books. He was a long-term instructor at the Drummers Collective in New York, and I think that's where his books were published through Drummers Collective. And then maybe like 15 or so years ago, he was hired at Berkeley up in Boston and ultimately ended up getting a full professorship up there. And then aside from that, wonderful player. I think some people are familiar with some of his playing, but we lost him this past week. So we wanted to give a quick shout out to Kim Plainfield and give our best to all those around him.
Yeah. RIP, my friend. Thanks for all that you did. And I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of people largely affected by that because he touched a lot of kids.
Oh, yeah.
And really, especially that education. I remember him. I think if I'm not mistaken, he played with Bill Connors.
He did, sir.
A friend of mine who is a just iconic bass player, Tom Kennedy. I remember years ago he mentioned he was playing with Bill, and he's like, "Man, this guy Kim, he's fantastic and muscular, yeah, and just has it all together." And I kind of listened to some of that Bill Connors stuff, and I was like, "Oh yeah, this dude's bad." But, you know, when Tom says you're bad because he plays with everybody.
Not to hijack this topic really quickly, but you brought on Bill Connors. Did you ever hear that track that Connors did that Weckl played on called Step It?
Yeah.
Insane.
Yep. That's Tom as well.
It is?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Or is it Anthony? I think it's Tom.
Yeah. But anyway, John, good show, man.
Does your toe hurt?
Why?
I dropped the name. I don't usually do that.
Oh.
I really try to keep from doing that, but Kim, I just think it's awesome that Tom Kennedy really respected him, and that speaks volumes about his talent.
You know Tom Kennedy, right?
I do. I played with Tom.
Hey, man,
quite a bit.
If you know him, and it's a fact. The facts don't care about your feelings, baby, so it's a fact.
That's that St. Louis thing, man.
My toe's not hurting.
You would be really surprised if you dug in and realized who's from St. Louis.
Chuck Berry.
Well, that pretty much sums it up right there. Miles Davis.
East St. Louis, baby, Miles Davis.
He played in St. Louis more than he played in East St. Louis.
So he crossed the river.
He did often.
Yeah. All right, guys. So we're going to wrap it up.
Some more?
No.
Dang it. Look it up.
We have to beg now. So listen, folks, when you are hearing this show, you've got less than 24 hours, or we'll say maybe 24 hours or less.
Michael McDonald.
Get over to iTunes Register yourself by leaving a short written review on the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast podcast homepage on iTunes, and you will be automatically registered for our drawing to win a Paiste 20 Series 10-inch splash and or a Gretsch Drums t-shirt. Leave us a review, folks. We would greatly, greatly appreciate it. And if you don't want to leave us a review, I'm sure we'll probably do another drawing in the future, but stay in touch with us. We like hearing from you guys. You guys are an active community. We appreciate hearing from you. You can always contact us through our email account, which is drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. You can interact with us at Facebook, facebook.com/drummersweeklygroovecast. And you can interact with us at Twitter, twitter.com/DWGroovecast, or as the kids say, at DWGroovecast, a mention, right? All right, subscribe to us. We're available on all your favorite podcast apps, iTunes, Google Play Podcast, Stitcher, Podbean, Player FM. Let's just go down the list, John.
David Sanborn.
What?
That list. I was still doing my list of...
You also just blew out my ears when... when you did that.
That'll be the first time I've ever been accused of that on this podcast, yeah. Ever.
All right. So I will stop this show now and put some compression on John's mic.
Did Bob Gibson play an instrument?
He used to... the instrument he used to play was fatalities of throwing 98-mile-an-hour fastballs at your face.
That's a good point. Stan Musial played harmonica.
Bob Gibson, was he the guy that made those guitars?
He might have.
He might have, man.
He's a pretty bright guy, man. Who knows? Yeah.
All right, anyway, guys. Subscribe to us. Listen to us. Love us.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being a part of it.
We'll see you on Facebook Live tomorrow. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.